I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bishops of the Anglican Church, the largest group of Christian churches after the Catholic and Orthodox, are meeting in Canterbury, England for their once-every-10-year assembly called the Lambeth Conference. According to one reporter, they are all desperate to address whether the church, with its 80 million members, can survive the consecration of Gene Robinson, the openly gay bishop of New Hampshire's Episcopalians. In a moment, we'll speak with Bishop Robinson, but first, Ruth Gledhill is religion reporter for the London Times. She's at the conference. And Ruth, around 220 bishops, mostly from Africa, are boycotting this summit. They met separately a few weeks ago. They also oppose the recent decision by the Church of England, the English Anglican Church, to allow women to be bishops. But those attending this conference, which way are they leaning in the debate over same-sex acceptance?
In the debate over same-sex blessings and gay consecration, the mood of the bishops is to try and stop it ever happening again. The conference is desperate to avoid the Anglican Communion fragmenting. And if the conference goes down a liberal route that is favoured by the Episcopal Church of the United States, undoubtedly there would be a serious split in the Anglican Communion.
But you also wrote that there's a growing consensus that the U.S. not be excluded.
Well, you've absolutely put your finger there on the fault line of the Anglican Communion. Yes, there is equally a very strong consensus that the Episcopal Church should not be excluded. The trouble is, if you have a church, an ecclesial body or a communion, where do you draw the line? And when they were proposing yesterday this new pastoral forum, it looks as though they're going to attempt to draw the line at gay consecrations and same-sex blessings. But that was yesterday. You know, today there is clear dissent from the liberal bishops in particular, and also from some of the, on the conservative side. The conservatives say this new proposal for the pastoral forum doesn't go far enough, and the liberals, of course, say it goes too far.
Well, this sense of drawing the line and banning further consecration of bishops and blessings of same-sex unions, first of all, is that meant to be in this proposal retroactive? Would that mean that Gene Robinson would be asked to step down?
Very good question, and it's exactly the question I asked Bishop Hanford yesterday. And he said, as regards Bishop Robinson, no, of course he couldn't be asked to step down because his election was canonically legal. But it certainly would be retroactive in terms of asking for any authorization of same-sex blessing services to not be used anymore. But, you know, everybody knows that there are dioceses, not just in America, but in throughout the West, really, certainly in England, where these services are performed regularly. They're just not authorised. It's just not done out in the open. You know, in the Church of England, it's been an accepted career path for generations for gay clergy. What we're seeing now is an attempt by the gay lobby to bring it out of the closet and to be open and honest about it. In England, when the Anglican Church reaches impasses of this kind, the Church of England, they fudge the issue. And that's how it's always held together in the 400 years since its inception. But here we have a different world now confronting us, and these kinds of compromises no longer seem to be acceptable to so many people. You know, when I've heard personal witnesses at Lambeth Conference this time from members of the Episcopal Church and of the justice issue, the way this is a justice issue working out in America, and how, you know, how devastating it would be for people in the Episcopal Church to suddenly be cast out into the cold simply because of their sexual orientation, I'm really moved by that. But also, I feel equally moved by the stories coming out of Africa. We had a very powerful witness statement from the Sudanese bishops saying to appear to be liberal on this issue in their cultural context exposed them to violence from their Muslim neighbours.
Well, and that Sudanese bishop, the bishop from Sudan, has called on the bishop from New Hampshire, Gene Robinson, to step down, saying he has to resign. And there's been talk for decades of a reunion of the Anglican and Catholic churches, the Anglican, of course, the Episcopal Church, the High Protestant Church. How much concern is there that either of these issues, the role of women or homosexuality, will be the end of that possibility of reunion with the Catholic Church?
Well, the ordination of women priests and bishops is being viewed with very grave concern in Rome. But there's a splinter movement where the traditionalists in the Church of England are having talks with Rome, and there seems to be a possibility that Rome might come up with some kind of corporate ecclesial solution which would allow the reception of these people back into Rome, because these people in the Anglican communion can't accept the ordination of women. So you might get a kind of splinter unity movement in that way. But I think as far as the rest of the Anglican Church is concerned, where there are women priests and bishops, certainly for the next century or two, there's no hope now of unity with Rome. Mm.
Ruth Gledhill, religion reporter for the London Times, reporting from the Lambeth Conference in Canterbury, England. Ruth, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson was consecrated 5 years ago and recently had a civil union with his partner of 20 years, Mark. Bishop Robinson was not invited to the conference in England, but he is participating in other events in Canterbury, and he joins us from a studio there. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Robin.
Well, the title of your new book is In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. You are definitely in the eye, even maybe if on the periphery, you're at least in the eye of the storm there. How are you feeling that?
Well, it's a very odd thing to be separated from my own House of Bishops, of course, and I'm the first bishop in the history of the Lambeth Conference, which dates back to 1867, the first bishop not to be invited. So that part of it feels very strange, and it's certainly disappointing to me.
Well, then why did you go if you were going to be confined to the periphery, as you said, and if your being there is seen by your critics as a sort of a further provocation? Why did you go?
Really, a couple of reasons. One pastoral and perhaps one prophetic. I wanted to be here to attest to the joy that I know in my own life from knowing a God who loves me the way I am and cherishes me as a child of God. I mean, that's what all Christians should be doing, is talking about that joy that they've found in their life. But the prophetic part, I think, is... frankly, I'm just not willing to let these guys meet. I mean, there are a few women here, but it's the guys who are the problem. I'm not willing to let these guys meet and pretend that they don't have gay and lesbian people sitting in their pews, no matter where they are around the world.
Well, not just in their pews, but according to you, in their pulpits. You're quoted in an interview saying that you've personally met with hundreds of closeted clergy in England where openly gay people cannot become Anglican priests. You said they have dinner with their bishops and their gay partners, and they're sort of a don't ask, don't tell. But some would say to you, why isn't that enough? You know, yes, they are there. They're active in the pulpit. It's just that they are quiet about their private lives.
You know, it's crazy making to ask clergy to get into a pulpit Sunday after Sunday and call the people to a life of integrity and then require them to tell lies about who they are. And it takes a terrible personal toll, but even more than that, it takes a terrible spiritual toll. Not to mention the gay and lesbian people sitting in those pews listening to that priest. It's not a good thing for a church to be doing, and I don't think it's something that God would want us to do.
Well, Bishop Robinson, let me ask you more about that, because you write in your book that the silence you endured as a closeted gay man was very painful, but not the same thing as being thrown into prison or burnt at the stake, although I should add, in some countries, you know, it is the same thing if you are gay. But staying with the point that you made, there are so many truly oppressive problems. Darfur, war in Iraq, global warming. And it seems that your church is now focused on gay rights. Do you ever, you know, have a second thought, worry that maybe, you know, is it selfish of me to do what your critics have said is, you know, hijacking the church for your issue? Because this is all the church seems to be talking about.
It's very interesting. You know, in my own diocese, where I spend 90% of my time, I almost never talk about this issue. We are getting about the work of the gospel, and we work with the poor and those who are in prisons and all kinds of ministry that I think God would have us be involved in. Oddly enough, it's the conservatives who are making this the central issue. The American church consented to my consecration by a two-thirds majority, and we would be just simply getting on with it, having one gay bishop, except that the conservatives want to throw us out of the communion, and that's why we're focusing on this.
Well, some would say that, you know, you have been more provocative than maybe you needed to. You had your civil union in June, right before Lambeth. You were quoted as saying, and you write about this in your book, you always wanted to be a June bride, which furthered the impression that some people have of, you know, gay men wearing dresses, which is something you've said you wanted to dispel. So could you respond to people who've said that both the Civil Union and that remark, you know, were more provocative than they needed to be? Why, first of all, the Civil Union in June?
One very simple reason. I have been receiving a number of death threats related to my coming to the Lambeth Conference. I have had to hire security to be with me 24 hours a day while I'm here.
Is it true you wear a bulletproof vest?
I'm actually not supposed to talk about any of the details what is actually happening. The fact of the matter is, with my life at risk, I was simply not willing to come to the Lambeth Conference without putting into place the protections for my partner and my daughters and granddaughters that a civil union accorded me. Civil unions only became legal in New Hampshire on January 1st, and we had our service in June, and we kept it a very private affair.
You say, doesn't Mark, your longtime partner, deserve the protections that are available to heterosexuals? And there are hundreds of those that have to do with, you know, financial and other matters.
That's exactly right. In terms of the benefits that are afforded couples in our society, you know, you have Britney Spears on a lark one night in Las Vegas deciding that she'll get married. And in that very instant, she gets all the rights and privileges accorded those who are married. And yet my partner and I have been together for more than 20 years, and those rights and privileges have not been available to us.
Can you explain for us, you talk in your book about the comment you made, "I always wanted to be a June bride." What was the context there, and what were your thoughts as the words left your mouth?
It's so interesting. You know, I had spoken for about an hour and a half at a law school in Florida, and then someone asked me about our upcoming civil union. And so I just threw out this comment. I thought it was kind of funny and fanciful and so on. I forgot that C-SPAN was there taping it. And literally before I got back to my hotel, that comment had gone around the world, and I was getting hate mail emails from around the world about it. Here's the very fascinating thing about it. I believe that there are deep connections between misogyny and homophobia, that at its root, what is really objectionable, mostly to men, is that homosexual men give up their male privilege and allow themselves to be treated like a woman, and nothing could be more degrading than that. I mean, if you look at that statement about "I always wanted to be a June bride," the only thing in it that might be objectionable is referring to myself with a feminine word. And that just drives men crazy. No one in their rightful mind who knows me or has heard of me would think that I would be in a wedding gown for my civil union. But I do think that the profound response to that statement really shows up that at the heart of this debate is really the hatred of women.
Well, you're right. You wished you just said that in marriage you wanted what all loving people want and skipped the bride reference. Well, that's openly gay New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. We're going to have more after a break. We'll be back in 1 minute here now. We're back with more from openly gay New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson in Canterbury, England, even though he wasn't invited to the Anglican Church Summit there. Bishop Robinson, your leader, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said the problem is that in the argument over homosexuality, each side is too ready to assume that the other is not listening to Christ. Are you guilty of that? Conservatives like Linda Harvey, the president of Mission America, an anti-gay rights group, say that Jesus may not have spoken directly about homosexuality, but he also didn't say anything about rape or incest, and that does not make them right, and that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed for immoral behavior, including homosexuality. So are you guilty, as the Archbishop says, of assuming that God is on your side?
Well, perhaps the Archbishop of Canterbury has not actually been listening to what I've been saying or reading what I've been writing. I've never said anything like that. As a matter of fact, quite to the contrary, Peter Akinola, perhaps my greatest critic, the Archbishop of Nigeria, I have always said that he is following his path back home toward God as faithfully as he can. I just wish he could acknowledge that I am as well. And I believe, and I've said many times, he and I will be in heaven together. I think that's going to shock him. But I believe that we are all doing the best we can. I want to be in a church with Peter Akinola. The problem is he doesn't want me to be in his church.
Well, so Bishop Robinson, are you saying that you feel that the Anglican Church can have different churches for different faiths? In other words, in Nigeria, if they want to bar gay priests and tell their congregants that homosexuality is evil, that that's okay with you?
Not only is it okay, but it has been our 500-year tradition. You know, Elizabeth I really formed our church, not Henry VIII. She had Protestants and Catholics trying to kill each other, and so she created a church, really, that is this very broad umbrella where if as long as we agree on the real basics, the ancient creeds and all of the basic doctrines of the Christian church, then within that context, we can disagree about a lot of things. I mean, across the world, we disagree about abortion and stem cell research or, you know, who should be president, whether or not we should be in Iraq. We can disagree about those things while agreeing on the basics. And that has always been our church tradition. And the conservatives right now want to give us a more centralized authority, much like the Roman Catholic Church, who will decide for everyone what is right and what is wrong on these non-essential matters. And that has never been our tradition.
Bishop Robinson, do you have any thoughts as I'm listening to you? Yes, you fear for your life, and that you know that's something that you know you just spoke to us of. And yes, this has been a pretty stormy fight, almost a schism in the church. But how would you put it in context? Because we're very aware at this moment in history of real religious divisions, Sunni Shia, you know, divisions in across Africa. How would you put this in that kind of worldwide context?
It's amazing to me that Christians, certainly, or certainly Jews and Christians, would think of conflict in the church as anything out of the ordinary. Scripture is full of stories of conflict in the early church. Peter and Paul, arguably the two greatest apostles, fought like cats and dogs, oddly enough, over who was going to be in and who was going to be out of the church, whether or not they had to become Jews first to become a follower of Jesus. And the history of the church has been a story of faithful people trying to discern what God's will is. And because God is, in the end, not completely knowable, and because we are always struggling to discern what that will is, we're going to have differences of opinion about that. The question is, how do we treat one another in the meantime? And there's nothing wrong with our disagreeing about the issue of homosexuality, but if we are treating one another in an unchristian way while we're trying to figure it out, then I think that breaks God's heart.
Well, and how do you think the Lambeth Conference is going? You're outside of it, but you have supporters who are inside, and we're hearing about Indaba groups, bishops breaking up into groups to use a Zulu model of talk-based conflict resolution. A Sri Lankan bishop suggested everyone play cricket. Do you have a sense that there is any healing or tempering going on?
Well, I do, and I think it's a lot easier than learning the rules of cricket, which I find completely impenetrable. You know, this is the part that I believe the Archbishop of Canterbury has gotten exactly right. What we don't need right now are more resolutions, more up or down votes, more proclamations by one side. What we need is the deepening of the bonds of affection that are the real ties that bind us. And I think these groups are precisely doing that. I just wish I could be part of those discussions.
But what about the fact that a quarter of the bishops are not there in protest. Can there be healing at this conference if, in fact, the people who are the most consider themselves the most grieved aren't even there?
I think healing would be very difficult without them here, and I think it's important to note that they absented themselves. No one disinvited them, and I think it points up the reality that we have a certain number of bishops in this church who are not working for reconciliation, but in fact want to see some kind of a split. But the three quarters of the bishops who are here, I believe, are very committed to holding the communion together. Despite the fact that we disagree about this and other issues, we find our unity in Christ.
Openly gay New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson, his new book is In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Do you believe that God's hand is behind all this? You know, when someone feels that they're God appointed in something, you know, there are people who back away from that.
I tell everyone that I see, be very, very careful of anyone who thinks they have God on their side. I think all that any of us can do is to do our very best to discern God's will. And, you know, I use a spiritual director to help me with my prayer life, and her primary job is to help me figure out whether the little voice that I hear in my head is God's voice or whether it's my own ego doing a magnificent impression of God's voice. And I think that's the task for all of us. I don't believe any one of us knows the will of God. That's why we need one another. That's why we need the community of the church. And together, we can figure that out.
Bishop Robinson from Canterbury, England, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin. It was great to be with you.
Okay, still ahead, how Johnny Cash found redemption at Folsom Prison after the news. Here and now. Zimmer Holdings, the country's biggest producer of orthopedic devices, recently suspended sales of a metal hip socket used in hip replacement surgery known as the Durham Cup because a number of patients who received the implants were in a new agony. The company says the cup isn't defective. They've said the problem is the doctor's implantation technique, but there may be hundreds of patients who received the implant who might now need a replacement for their replacement. And as the New York Times points out today, as opposed to other countries, there is no national system for tracking these devices in the U.S. Well, our next guest knows a bit about tracking. He once worked for the Joint Registry in Sweden. Dr. Henrik Malkow is now an orthopedic surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. Today, he joins us from Sweden, where he's on vacation. And Dr. Malkow, first of all, tell us more. How are American patients at higher risk because the U.S. doesn't have a national joint registry like Sweden does?
Due to two facts, the tracking as such will very soon show up defective or less optimal functioning implants, which can then be modified or removed from the market. And number two, the individual surgeon will, having a registry, get feedback from the registry how he's performing and correct if anything is inappropriate.
Well, to show how the system worked in Sweden, there was another replacement made by Sulzer. Just 30 patients got one in Sweden because the joint registry there showed that there were problems. So the Swedes stopped using it long before Americans did. About 3,000 Americans got the device.
No, actually 17,000 Americans got the device.
More than
3,000 was revised.
Ah, I see. So 17,000 actually got it. 3,000 had so many problems that they had to have replacements. And I guess the problem was that it had been contaminated by oil during manufacturing. Why is it that, you know, if there is this tracking in Sweden, Americans must know about it? Even if there wasn't a national registry, aren't there trade magazines? Why were doctors in America still putting so many of the Sulzer replacements in when there was such a problem demonstrated in Sweden?
No, it was never public demonstrated in Sweden. We looked it up during the time when it really surfaced in U.S., and that's how it worked.
Ah. Well, you are there in Sweden, as we said, on vacation, but you work there at the Swedish registry. Is there also a sense in Europe that American doctors may be too quick to go with new technology before something's been tested?
Yeah, I mean, it serves the patients best if we base our implant choice and surgical technique choice on evidence, and they're pretty strict and well-defined rules how you can create evidence. Registry is one of those tools as such.
Yeah. What is the opposition to a registry here in the U.S.?
I think the major opposition is fear for misuse of the data. The data need to be protected. until there is confidence that the data are correct, that we have a sufficient amount of patients collected. And I think that's the major issue in U.S. is really fear for legal misuse.
Some have said that lawyers might troll the data, you know, to look for clients if they see problems showing up.
Exactly. And that happens over and over again in U.S.
But the trade-off, you know, the fact that patients might know, it was a Dr. Lawrence Dorr of Los Angeles who started seeing the problems with the Durham Cup from Zimmer Holdings. He called the company. He talked to salespeople. He's a highly paid consultant for Zimmer Holdings, who again, make this a hip replacement. And nobody listened to him.
Yeah, yes and no. Zimmer definitely listened. They still judged that his surgical technique was not appropriate for that particular implant. If we have had a registry, it would be so easy to confirm whether his finding was correct.
He did that himself. He started talking to other colleagues at trade shows. Maybe you. Did he speak with you?
I talked to Larry Dorr about this as well. Yes, I did.
And what was your thinking? I mean, he says that he started to hear from other colleagues they were having the same problem.
There could be a surface problem with the implant, but still the registry would be the best way to get the answer.
Whether or not the problem is the doctor's technique, it would be something that people would soon find out about.
Yes.
And by the way, what is the problem with the Durham Cup? What is it not doing?
It's not getting bony ingrown. The bone should go in and fix the implant permanently, and that seems not to happen for quite a large proportion of the Durham patients.
What did you say, bony ingrown?
It's bony ingrown. After you do the surgery, you press fit the implant, and then the bone grow into the surface of the implant, and then you get the permanent fixation.
They fuse because bones are a living thing. But
yeah.
And so what is happening for the patients in that this Durham Cup is not fusing with the bone?
They get the pain and will be in need of revision, at least 10% in a 2-year follow-up for Dr. Dorr's patients.
I know a lot of people had a chuckle last week when this first was in the news because the company, in making the announcement that there were problems with the Durham Cup, said, but there would be no need for a recall. Well, everybody, you know, immediately thought, what are you supposed to do, go reach in your hip and take it out and send it back? What are people doing now? Because there were nearly 1 million hip and knee replacements in the U.S. just last year. So what do you recommend that people do if they're feeling like they're having pain?
No, you're meaning all hip knees need proper follow-up, which means, and it's really the patient's responsibility to go back and check on their hips. An x-ray and a short examination of a doctor will do it. And the younger you are as a patient, the more important it is to go back and check.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times also pointed out today that Zimmer Holdings, the same company, still sells a knee implant. It's called the Unispacer. They still sell it here in the U.S., even though doctors in Australia stopped using it 3 years ago after their registry showed it had failed quickly in half of the 40 patients who got it. Now, again, according to the Times, Zimmer is saying today that it continues to sell the device here because some surgeons say that it helps certain patients with specific conditions.
And I wouldn't argue against that. It's not really a knee implant. It's a temporary device that you can get in between getting a permanent joint surgery. It's not attached to bone. It's like a floating meniscus. And it can keep the patients 5 or 7 years from the real surgery, which can be an advantage for many young patients.
Right. So it sounds as if a consumer really has to be informed. Doctors really have to be informed. We understand that hospitals here in the U.S. are setting up their own tracking systems.
Yeah, Mass General have almost 10 years now registry that covers hip and knee implants. We recently started up for shoulder, for spine devices and spine surgeries as well, and we are in the movement doing this for the rest of the services at Mass General Hospital.
And has having the registry, you know, affected how you do implants?
Maybe not directly, but indirectly. What happens is that surgeons need to be aware that we need evidence, which means they would be more reluctant to start up new without creating the needed evidence. We do use new technology, but we document it very carefully and report that in the scientific literature.
And despite the concern about, you know, people maybe using the data from a registry, do you think there will be a national one?
I'm sure there will be a national registry in U.S. It started in the state of Virginia already. There is a possibility that registry will be used nationwide. But U.S. is a huge country. You can't start a registry overnight, but we need to get started somehow, and I'm sure it will come now.
Dr. Henrik Malkow is an orthopedic surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. We are speaking to him in Sweden, where he happens to be on vacation, but where he also worked on their national joint registry for 10 years. Dr. Malkow, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick programming note. When wildfires burn, as they are near Yosemite, do you know what firefighters call it when aircraft are calling to drop water? They call them CNN drops. They say they're just for show. Later this week, we'll get inside the world of forest firefighting. You're listening to Here Now. Well, it's not easy being green, as Kermit said, but it's especially hard now that so many companies market products that are environmentally friendly, and many of them are greenwashing, well, lying. Dr. Yurvashi Rangan is the Senior Scientist for Policy Initiatives for Consumer Union and the Project Director for Consumer Reports GreenerChoices.org website. Dr. Rangan, how do you tell if a product is living up to its green promise?
Well, it is hard to tell, and especially with all the product lines that contain claims like natural or green. There are no standard definitions for what those terms have to mean. Something can even be plant-derived, but be chemically altered from when it was squeezed out of the plant or extracted from the plant. A lot of companies still call that natural. We don't. But because there's no standard definition, there isn't any real hard line for companies to follow. So consumers need to do a little extra work to figure out if the product that they're buying is meeting their expectations.
Well, Clorox, let's stick with their Greenworks products. They've defined natural as ingredients that come from primarily plant or mineral materials and contain less than 1% petrochemicals. But as you point out, that still doesn't tell you whether or not something that is natural might be toxic or irritating.
That's exactly right. And a lot of people who do have, say, very sensitive skin or have asthma may indeed react to certain things, even in these natural products. But because they don't have to list those ingredients, it's hard to tell.
So cleaning products aren't like other products that are regulated. They don't have to list the ingredients.
That's right. It's really unfortunate, but cleaning products seem to be in a world of their own when it comes to supermarket shelves, and that can make it especially hard for consumers to do comparative shopping in that product category.
What about third-party endorsements? What can you look for?
Well, there are some third-party endorsements, and we haven't actually gone through and rated all of them yet, but you will see things like Green Guard or Green Seal. The EPA also has a label out called Design for the Environment, and I saw a recent slogan underneath it, which it said, Safer Chemicals for the Consumer. And I think that's kind of where it's at. It may be safer, but where are these companies? Where even is EPA drawing the line at safety? It behooves you to, one, if you're going to buy one of these products and spend more, to flip it over and look for an ingredient panel to really make sure that it's void of the ingredients you don't want and has some of the ingredients that you do want.
Just to stay with the endorsements for a second, as you write, you can't always be completely sure of them. You point out that, for instance, a Sierra Club label is going to be on some of the Clorox Greenworks products, but Sierra Club might receive some financial support from Clorox. That's not indicting them, but it's something people might want to know.
It is true that in some cases, Sierra Club is taking some kind of kickback from the sale of these products. That puts it into a different context where a company may be supporting an environmental effort, but don't confuse that for greenness of a product.
What about green products from green companies? I'm thinking Seventh Generation and other companies. Can you always trust them?
We did look at some seventh generation products. I think we had an article called The Biodegradable Claims at Seventh Generation Break Down, and it was a dishwashing detergent labeled with biodegradable on the front of it. It turns out that the main ingredient was not biodegradable. Now, that's not to say every product Seventh Generation makes then is lying about what it does, and I think the company after that in earnest went and took that label down from their products. But again, without third-party verification, companies get into this very tricky area where they're doing their own verification of their own marketing, of their own greenness of their products. And sometimes I think they can be in a bit of a vacuum.
But bottom line, even though there may be some questions, even though products may be not as green as they claim, is a little bit greener than they used to be better?
I think so. I think that these companies trying to make these greener formulations are headed in the right direction. But again, have they reached the end of the rainbow when it comes to green? I think not, and I think there's probably more room to go.
Dr. Urvashi Rangan, Senior Scientist for Policy Initiatives for Consumer Union and the Project Director for Consumer Reports, greenerchoices.org. We'll link to it at our website, here-now.org. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, he went to Folsom Prison with Johnny Cash in 1 minute, here and now. Hello, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and...
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
All this year, we've been looking back at some of the significant cultural events from the pivotal year of 1968. Today, let's revisit one of the most famous live performances ever recorded. On January 13, 1968, Johnny Cash, along with June Carter and Cash's band, the Tennessee Three, played at Folsom State Prison in Folsom, California. The recording quickly became legend. Rolling Stone magazine ranked At Folsom Prison 88 on its list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. And Gene Bealey was there. In 1968, Bealey was a reporter for the Star Free Press in Ventura, California. He accompanied the Cashes to the concert, even made his own recordings there, as we'll hear. And Gene joins us now from KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, so tell us, first of all, yes, you were with Johnny and June, you know, just seemingly an ordinary couple, you know, as they're getting ready to go to Folsom to do the concert. Could you detect, did they have a sense of what was about to happen? Did they have a sense of something special? Because, as you remind us, they'd played Folsom before.
Yes, I don't think we had a sense that it would become a legend like it has. It was just a great day and beautiful weather. And
Well, in fact, you say great day. What did June Cash say when she got off the plane in Sacramento after the flight?
Oh, I'll never forget that. She said, "Wow, it's a beautiful huckleberry picking day."
Well, you write that it was a Ventura pastor named Floyd Gressett who was instrumental in getting Cash to Folsom. He ministered to prisoners there. He knew Johnny Cash. The prisoners asked him to get Cash to come. He does. So there you all are. What was it like the moment you went inside the prison with John and June?
Well, I personally had never been inside a prison before, so it was awesome. When that gate slammed behind you, you knew what it felt like when a prisoner comes in and maybe never sees the outside again.
Yeah. Well, that was your first time in prison, but Johnny Cash had been in jail 7 times for misdemeanors. He'd had a lot of run-ins with the law. So, you know, what was the prisoner's perception of Johnny Cash at this point? He wasn't a huge star yet, but who was he to them?
Well, they knew him because as we walked through the yard, there were the smiles, and he'd talk to him directly, say, "How you doing?" And I think they felt like he was one of them.
Early one morning while making the rounds, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. I went right home and I went to bed. I stuck that loving 44 beneath my head.
So they identified with Cash when he sang songs like Cocaine Blues or 25 Minutes to Go. That's his satirical look at a convict's last moments before his execution. But Cash also sang some softer, almost sentimental songs, like Send a Picture of Mother. Let's listen to that.
Say hello to Dad and shake his poor, hard-working hand, and send a picture of Mother if you can. I'm happy for you that you got your freedom, but stay with me just another minute or so.
Well, you were a reel-to-reel recorder in. How did you get a reel-to-reel recorder into a Johnny Cash concert?
I had a big old Sony for doing research. And when I got to the gate, of course, the Columbia record executives like Bob Johnson said, "You can't bring that in here." And John smiled and says, "Yes, you can. He's my friend, and he's a reporter for the Ventura paper." End of story for him. And so he personally okayed it.
Well, and let's listen to some of what you caught, because there's a difference between your recordings and the Columbia Records recordings. Let's listen to, for instance, Folsom Prison Blues. We remember Johnny Cash sings that famous line about shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die. Now, on the album, listen to how the prisoners react.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Now let's listen to your recording.
But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Well, now, the prisoner reaction on your recording, Gene, is much more muted. Do you think it's possible that Columbia might have added some cheering just to make those prisoners, just to juice up the prisoner's reaction to shooting a man?
Well, of course, that's engineering in a studio. They can do anything they want, can't they?
Yeah.
But it was a different perspective in some of my recordings, since the tape recorder may have been positioned differently.
Yeah. Well, another thing that you witnessed and we learned through you is more about Reverend Gressett. This was, again, the pastor who got Johnny Cash to Folsom Prison. Before the concert, in those meetings and hanging out in the hotel, he introduced Johnny Cash to a song that was written by a prisoner. It's called Greystone Chapel. Tell us more about this song and how he reacted to it, and then how it ended up on the playlist that night.
Well, we were sitting around the El Rancho Motel here in Sacramento the night before the concert. And that's when Reverend Gressett said, John, I've got a demo tape here I promised that you'd listen to. And he said, well, anybody got a tape recorder? So I raised my hand and he says, go get it. So I stood over John while he wrote down the lyrics. And they had a little rehearsal that night.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be, but my Lord has set my soul free.
And then he announced the next morning at the concert that he was going to sing my friend Glenn Shirley's song, Greystone Chapel. And Glenn Shirley, the inmate, he jumped about 3 feet in the air. I've never seen such a happy guy in my life.
Hope we do your song justice, Glenn. We're going to do our best.
What a moment for Glenn Shirley. And what did Glenn Shirley go on to do?
John actually got him a pardon from Governor Reagan and hired him, put him on a show, but the sad ending was that he committed suicide.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be, but my Lord has set my soul free.
When I saw John and June at an airport many years later, I asked them what happened, and they didn't seem like they wanted to talk about it. They just said it was drugs.
And maybe the pressure of the big time with Johnny Cash, you know, maybe it was too much. Well, you know, back to the concert at Folsom. I asked you if they seemed to know going in what was about to happen. You said no. Coming out, did they understand what had happened?
Well, I think there was a lot of excitement over it. I can remember sitting with John and Bob Johnston, his producer from Columbia Records. And Bob called some of the Columbia Record executives back east. He was just bowling over with enthusiasm, saying, oh, this is going to be a great record, a great album. And so I think that they recognized afterwards that it was above the norm.
That's Gene Bealey. He was a young reporter for the Star Free Press in Ventura, California in 1968 and accompanied Johnny Cash and June Carter to the Folsom Prison concert on January 13th. Thank you so much for all of the wonderful sound that you provided today in your story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be, but my Lord has set my soul free.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Have an announcement from Lieutenant Piper. Steady. Duffy, number 9047, custody office.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
John Cash, don't you?
Sort of like to, yeah.
Johnny?
PRI, Public Radio International.